free.
She a good lay? I bet she is. I bet you can do whatever you want to a girl like that.
Stop it.
I've been thinking about all the things I could do to her. Tell her to take her clothes off.
Stop.
Have her suck my dick. And that's when I punched them. I never punched anyone in my life, but before I knew it, I squeezed my hand shut, drew back my elbow, and punched Garrett right in the side of the neck. I'd been aiming for his face, but I missed.
Jesus!
He shouted, falling back. Then he ran at me, throwing his arms around my waist, ramming his head into my stomach, tackling me to the floor.
Get off me! I yelled.
Garrett socked me so hard I could taste blood in my mouth. All his weight was on top of me, pinning me to the floor. Very dimly, I was aware of a small crowd forming around us. Garrett nailed me a few more times in the chest and the ribs before Mr. Baker, the driver's ed instructor, broke it up.
That's enough, he said, prying us apart. Up on your feet, boys!
Garrett shook Mr. Baker off and paced in a tight circle. Mr. Baker snatched Garrett's coat sleeve.
Settle down, he said.
I put my hand to my mouth and felt my bloodied lip split right down the center. What had just happened? Had I really punched him? But instead of feeling pain or any kind of remorse, I felt exhilarated.
Principal's office for both of you, Mr. Baker said, still working to corral Garrett. And then we're calling both of your parents.
Garrett spat out a laugh.
Something funny, Mr. Miller?
Good luck with that.
With what?
Listen, you talk to my dad, do me a favor, and ask him where the fuck he's been. I haven't seen him in 3 days.
Mr. Baker took a deep breath.
Come on, he said. We're going to sort this all out.
The school wanted my parents to come in for a conference.
What is this about?
My dad asked when my mom mentioned it that afternoon. She had intercepted him at the door when he got home from work.
We need to go meet with his teachers, my mom explained.
All of his teachers?
I don't know. Maybe just the guidance counselor. But I told them we would come in as soon as you got home. Someone's there waiting for us.
I was standing by my bedroom door, out of view. But I could hear everything my parents were saying. I had gone straight to my room when I came home, holding my phone over my mouth as I walked through the apartment, trying to hide my swollen, cracked lip from my mom, and I hadn't come out since. The school nurse had wanted to clean off the blood, but I'd begged her to leave it alone, and now I kept looking at it, dried and crusty in the mirror, in amazement.
Now?
My dad said.
They want to see us as soon as possible.
My dad sighed.
Is he in there?
He's in his room, but he won't tell me anything. We can talk to him when we get home. Come on, let's go.
Don't push me.
We need to go. I knew my mom was trying to guide my dad out the door, probably thumping him on the leg with her purse. My dad shouted into the apartment,
What did you do, Mayor?
Before I heard the door click shut. An hour and a half later, I was sitting on my bed, awaiting my fate, when my dad stomped down the hallway and swung open the door to my room. He wasn't a huge guy, but he was breathing in a way that seemed to inflate him. And he stood there, staring at me, his neck bent over, his arms down at his sides. I swallowed hard. In the time that he and my mom had been gone, I'd talked myself into the idea that maybe my dad would be proud of me. Just a little bit, when he found out I'd gotten into a fight. Maybe it proved I had a little bit of machismo in me after all. Plus, it was something that not even Enrique had ever done, at least not that I knew of. But now, seeing my dad's face, I could tell that idea was out the window. Silence festered in the room. I swallowed again, trying to get down the saliva that had collected in my mouth. My dad closed the door behind him. He paced in front of me, breathing like a bull. I sat on my hands and stared at my knees. After what must have been 5 full minutes, I said,
What?
My dad stopped pacing and looked at me like I had just broken the first rule of engagement. Like I should have known that I wasn't supposed to talk first.
What?
My dad repeated incredulously.
What?
I'll tell you what. You punched someone.
He deserved it.
My dad started pacing again. And suddenly, somehow, I knew that the fight wasn't the thing that was bothering him. After another long stretch of silence, he said,
Your counselor told us your grades are slipping.
I hung my head. So that's what this was about. I'd been spending so much time with Maribel lately that I hadn't really been focused on things like homework. But then my dad said,
I asked her if it was because you were spending too much time at soccer.
Something dropped through me like a runaway elevator.
Shit, I thought. Shit, shit, shit.
My dad was still pacing. I tried to steel myself for whatever was coming next. There was a distinct possibility, I thought, that he was going to hit me. Not that he'd ever done it before. He'd thrown things and kicked things, but I sometimes had the sense when he got angry that he was only about an inch away from getting physical. As if so far over the years, even though the thought might have crossed his mind, he'd been able to control himself. But that if he were pushed too far into the fire, there would be no stopping him.
You lied, he said.
I nodded.
This whole time!
I nodded again. My dad worked his jaw from side to side.
This whole time!
I'm sorry, I said.
You made me look like a fool tonight. Is that what you think I am, a fool?
No, I squeaked.
I thought you were out there, every day, playing, part of the team. But what have you been doing instead? Drugs? Drinking?
No!
How can I know?
I'm not, Bobby.
This whole time, he screamed.
And he lunged toward me, squeezing my shoulders between his hands like a vice, lifting me to my feet. His nostrils flared, and he looked me right in the eyes.
God damn it, Mayor!
He dug his fingertips into my skin, like he was trying to carve his way down to my bone. I didn't want to cry, but I could feel my eyes burning. My dad brought his face close to mine, close enough so that the tips of our noses almost touched.
You're done, he said.
Christmas that year was both the best and the worst we'd had in a while. There was this kind of pall over everything, heavy and sticky, like a film we couldn't get out from under. It hadn't taken long to deduce that you're done meant I was grounded until further notice. No Maribel, no William, no allowance. No nothing but school and home until my dad decided otherwise. And on top of that, my dad announced the next night, no Christmas presents this year either.
Wait until you see the pile of gifts we're getting, Enrique,
my dad said.
A mountain of gifts. That will teach you not to lie to me again.
My mom argued that my dad was being hard on me, but he didn't want to hear it. Which meant that what to do with me became just one more source of tension between them. On Christmas Eve, the three of us took a bus to the Wilmington train station to meet Enrique, who was coming home for a few days for the holidays. My mom had begged him to stay longer, but he claimed he needed to be back on campus for some obscure reason he never disclosed. Even so, a few days was better than nothing. I needed any buffer I could get, and my mom was busting at the seams in anticipation of seeing her baby boy again, as she kept saying.
He's a grown man now, my dad told her. He's still my baby,
my mom insisted. When Enrique came down the steps into the train vestibule, he was wearing a hooded sweatshirt that said Maryland across the front and black athletic pants. He was unshaven, carrying a duffel bag in his hand. Honestly, he looked homeless.
Kiko,
my mom shouted, running to him, wrapping her arms around his neck. Hey, Ma. I heard him say. When my mom and Enrique walked over to us, my dad took my brother's bag out of his hands and patted him on the back.
Here he is, my dad said. My good son.
I shrank a little. My mom looked at me with pity.
How was the train?
My dad asked. Decent, Enrique said, then punched me in the shoulder.
Hey, I said. What's up, kid?
We caught the bus back home, and when we arrived, my mom started preparation for Enrique's favorite meal, which was pork tamales. She reminded him that we were going to church that night, but he begged off, saying he was tired and needed to catch up on sleep. I couldn't believe it when my dad didn't put up a fight. Instead, he just said,
Is the coach working you hard up there?
Yeah, Pop, Enrique said. You could count on my mom, though.
But it's Christmas, she argued. One time a year, God would like to see your face. One time.
He doesn't see it every day? Enrique asked.
In church, my mom clarified. He would like to see your face in church, and so would I.
Enrique looked at my dad like, she can't be serious, can she?
He's tired, Celia, my dad said. He can be tired later.
Enrique looked at my dad again, but this time my dad seemed resigned to the fact that there was no way he and Enrique would win this battle. My mom would wear them down eventually.
I tried, he said half-heartedly.
Later, as I was getting dressed for mass, Enrique knocked on my door.
Why are you getting ready so early?
He asked when he saw me. I didn't tell him it was because I was eager to see Maribel, who I knew would be there. I had a feeling she wouldn't measure up to my brother's standards. I mean, if all he did was look at her, she would have made the grade, no problem. But if he knew the whole story? Nothing better to do, I said. He laughed.
Yeah, I heard about that. What did you do anyway? How did the angel child get grounded?
My lip had pretty much healed by then. There was just a faint kind of purplish line where the split had been, but I pointed it out to him anyway. I got in a fight.
Enrique's eyes widened. You mean by accident?
Nope. I started it. I punched someone.
Man, Enrique said. You turned into a tough guy while I was gone.
He sat on my bed and looked around like he was trying to figure out if anything had changed since the summer, which was the last time he'd been home.
There's no way I could live here again, he said. This place is so depressing. Every time I come back, it seems shittier.
It's not that bad,
Enrique chuckled. That's just because you don't know any better.
I got my clip-on tie out of the drawer and started to hook it to my collar.
See, that's what I'm talking about, Enrique said. All these rules, like God cares whether or not you're wearing a tie.
You used to wear a tie to church, too, I said.
Exactly, used to, but I wouldn't be caught dead in that thing now.
It's not a big deal.
My brother shook his head. One day, you'll get out of here and you'll see.
I tried to imagine it, going off to college in a few years, walking into a life that was all my own, one where I didn't have to wear a tie to church, one where I didn't have to go to church, where no one could ground me, and where I could do whatever I wanted. I pulled the tie off and tossed it on the bed.
Fuck that, I said, a little too loudly.
Enrique laughed.
That's what I'm talking about.
We rode the bus to midnight mass with the Riveras, although Enrique sat all the way in the back, plugged into his iPod, so it was basically like he wasn't even there. The bus driver tuned the radio to the all-Christmas music station, and when Feliz Navidad came on, I guess since we were the only people on the bus, he raised the volume and shouted back at us,
Here you go, a little piece of home for you.
Under his breath, my dad said,
Every year the same thing. If it's in Spanish, it's a piece of home. Well, I never heard this song until I came to the United States.
And every year you complain, my mom said.
You like this song?
No.
It's like how everyone thinks I like tacos. We don't even eat tacos in Panama,
my dad said.
That's right. We eat chicken and rice, my mom said.
And seafood. Corvina as fresh as God makes it.
Yes.
This was one of the few things that could unite my parents, the thread that mended them,
their conviction that no one else here understood Panama the way they did. I was sitting in front of them with my feet up on the seat, my dress socks pulled halfway up my calves. I had my coat zipped to my chin so that my mom wouldn't see that I wasn't wearing my tie. The Riveras were across the aisle from us. "I like tacos," I offered. My mom sighed. "Why would you say such a thing?" "What about you, Maribel?" I asked. "Do you like tacos?" When she didn't answer, I repeated the question louder. She was pressing the pad of her thumb against her incisors. She said, "My teeth are really sharp." "So you could eat a crunchy taco?" I asked. "Okay," she said. My mom swatted my shoulder. "Leave her alone," she said. "I was just asking if she liked tacos." "I don't know what that means," my mom said. "Tacos? It means tacos. I don't know if you mean something else by it now, all this taco talk." That made me laugh. Taco talk. And as soon as I laughed, I realized I hadn't done it in a long time. Too long. And I remembered how good it felt. How it made my muscles warm and filled me up with the kind of lightness that was usually missing in my life. The kind of lightness that was buried under my parents' bickering and under my awkwardness at school. I stared out the window into the dark, at the illuminated trail of streetlights streaking through the air, and laughed while everyone else on the bus stayed quiet. The next morning, my mom brewed a pot of café Ruiz, our annual treat, and brought out the rosca bread with almonds that she'd made the night before. Our apartment was decked out with the same tired decorations she displayed every year. Angel figurines on the end tables. A crocheted snowman cozy that slid over the extra roll of toilet paper in the bathroom. A dried wreath with a red velvet bow that she hung over the kitchen doorway. A porcelain nativity scene on the floor. We hadn't gotten a tree, and as threatened, I didn't get any presents. Enrique didn't exactly get a mountain of stuff either, unless a 4-pack of deodorant and a new Gillette razor along with a bunch of replacement blades counted. "I'm not really into shaving anymore," Enrique said when he opened them. When I offered to take them, he laughed and said, "Oh yeah, you can use them on that non-existent hair above your lip." Besides him, the only person who got a gift was my mom. And it was nothing more than a lousy set of shampoo and conditioner that my dad swore he bought at the salon, even though anyone could see from the sticker on the back that he'd gotten it from the clearance shelf at Kohl's. My mom placed a set on the coffee table. None of us mentioned the sticker. My mom called my tía Gloria, only to learn that my aunt had finally decided to file for a divorce from my tío Esteban, news that sent my mom into a low-level state of shock. Not because she hadn't seen it coming, but because of her adamant objection to divorce. Anyone's divorce. But by the time the receiver was back on the latch, my mom was on a high from talking to her sister at all, which always cheered her at least for the short term, until the cheer was displaced by missing her again. Late in the morning, the radiators died, and my dad did what he always did, kick them and curse, until he gave up and plopped down on the couch. Not long after, the telephone rang. It was Señora Rivera, calling my mom to tell her that the heat was out and to ask what they were supposed to do. My mom told her just to wait, that it would come back on eventually. "The Riveras?" my dad asked from the couch when my mom hung up the phone. "I bet they're freezing their asses off. They never thought they would leave Mexico for this, I'm sure." "We should invite them over," I said. "Why?" my mom asked. I seized up. Why? It wasn't like we had heat either. What was I going to say? Just because I wanted to see Maribel? Because I bought her a present about a month ago, a red scarf that had cost me basically all of my allowance, and that I'd wrapped in tissue paper and had been keeping under my bed for her, and now that I was grounded, I didn't know how I was going to get it to her? "We should invite everyone over," I said. "The whole building. More body heat will warm everyone up." "Genius," Enrique said sarcastically. "It's true," I said,
It's thermodynamics and radiation. They've proved it. But when Señora Rivera called again at noon, concerned because the apartment was getting colder by the minute, my mom told them to stop by. Then she hung up and dialed Nelia and Quisqueya and told them to spread the word. She pulled out every candle we owned and lit match after match until the wicks were all burning with tiny flames.
"It's pretty like this, don't you think?" she said.
And I had to admit, it did look nice. Before she could brew another pot of coffee, people were knocking on our door, wishing us Merry Christmas and gripping bottles of rum in their gloved hands. Everyone kept their coats and hats on. Quisqueya was wearing her fur hat on her head, which I always thought made her look Russian. Micho brought his camera, roaming around the apartment snapping pictures of everyone who was already there. Benny flashing the peace sign. Nelia sitting cross-legged on the couch, nursing a beer that my dad had given her. Quisqueya sitting next to her, pretending like she wasn't interested in having her photo taken. When the Riveras showed up, Micho bunched the three of them together in front of our door and made them pose while he snapped a shot. Maribel stared right at the camera, but she didn't smile. So I went up behind Micho, waving my arms and making goofy faces to see if she would react. When she cracked a grin, Micho said, "There we go, that was a good one." Not long after, Jose Mercado and his wife Inez showed up, her gripping his elbow while he hobbled with his walker.
"Gustavo had to work," Benny told my dad, even though my dad hadn't asked. "Movie theater might be the only place that's open on Christmas Day."
"Hollywood doesn't believe in God," my dad said.
Benny laughed.
"But God sure believes in Hollywood. Have you seen those women? Megan Fox and the mouth on Angelina Jolie? God is in the details, man."
My dad raised his beer.
"Salud!"
"Despicable," Quisqueya said. Even our landlord, Fito Mosquito, that's what I called him, stopped by long enough to poke his head in the front door and announce that Delmarva, the energy company, was on their way to fix the heat.
"Don't blame me," he said.
"Don't worry," Micho shouted. "We won't blame you. We'll just deduct it from our rent checks this month."
Fito wagged his finger, and a few people laughed. Micho said,
"We're just teasing you, man. Come on inside."
The radiators didn't kick back on until late that night. But with all the people packed into our apartment that afternoon, it started to feel a little more like Christmas. Everyone shivering and laughing and drinking and talking. When we ran out of coffee, my mom mixed up huge pots of hot cocoa that she made from heavy cream and some chocolate bars she'd found in the back of a cabinet and melted down. Señor Rivera asked if she had cinnamon sticks to put in the cups to make it Mexican style, and my mom found a jar of powdered cinnamon in a cabinet that she sprinkled into the pot.
"Are you happy now?" she joked. "It always has to be the Mexican way. Mexico, Mexico, as if the rest of us don't exist." "Viva Mexico!" Micho shouted from the corner of the room.
"Mexico!"
Arturo said.
"Panama!"
my dad said.
"Presente!"
my mom said, and everyone laughed.
"Nicaragua!"
Betty shouted.
"Presente!"
"Puerto Rico!"
Jose said.
"Presente!"
Inez and Nelia chimed at the same time.
"Venezuela!"
shouted Quisqueya.
"Presente!"
"Paraguay!"
said Fito.
"Presente!"
Then, Feliz Navidad came on the radio.
"This goddamn song again,"
my dad said.
"Oh, come on," my mom said.
She started singing along and swishing her hips while my dad eyed her skeptically.
"What?" she said. "You don't want to dance with me? Fine. Benny Ring."
And Betty took my mom by the hand, spinning her around. Inez and Jose joined in, Jose leaning on his walker while he rocked back and forth, and Micho pulled Nelia up off the couch into a twirl. Almost everyone in the room started singing along, and eventually my dad put his drink down and cut in on Benny and my mom, sliding his arm around her waist.
"Now this is more like it.
my dad yelled above the noise. This is like the Christmases I knew! I took the dancing as the opening I'd been waiting for, and stole Maribel away so that I could give her my present. We sat at the end of the hallway outside my bedroom where no one could see us, and I handed her the square lumpy package I had wrapped. You can open it, I said. It's for you. I felt nervous all of a sudden, like maybe it was too much or maybe she wouldn't like it. It's light, she said, and I nodded, anxious for her to get on with it. She pried off a piece of tape and folded open the tissue paper at one end. She held it up at eye level and squinted inside. It's a scarf, I said, before she'd even pulled it out all the way. It's alpaca. She unfolded the whole thing and laced her fingers through the yarn fringe at the ends. Do you like it? I asked. Yes. I picked out a red one so that it would match your sunglasses. It's so soft. It's alpaca, I said again, like I was suddenly some kind of alpaca salesman or something. She wrapped the scarf around her neck. I'm sorry I haven't seen you, I said. My dad grounded me. What is that? She asked. It means he's not letting me go anywhere besides school. Whatever, it's not a big deal. I just wanted you to know why I haven't been around. She nodded. I wanted you to know that it isn't that I don't want to see you. Okay. Then, there in the shadows of the hallway, I kissed her. This strange electricity shot through my body. My first real kiss. Her skin was warm, and she smelled like laundry detergent and frost, as fresh as the winter air. She pulled away first, but she peeked at me and smiled. All I wanted was to do it again, to kiss her, to inhale her, to feel her mouth against mine. I was fuzzy with the thought of it, like I'd somehow slipped underwater. But then, from the living room, my dad started singing along in English. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas from the bottom of my heart, warbling like a yodeler on heart. And Maribel giggled, and the moment passed.
Adolfo Fito Angelino. I came here in 1972 because I wanted to be a boxer, like the great Juan Carlos Jimenez, who was from Paraguay, like me. There was a trainer in Washington, D.C., who was good, who was very good, legendary, and who specialized in flyweight fighters, which is what I was, skinny but strong. I wrote the trainer a letter, Sully Samuelson. What a name. And he wrote me back, a letter signed with his name. He told me he wasn't taking on new fighters, but that if I was ever in D.C., I should look him up. Maybe he assumed that because I was all the way over in Paraguay, the chances weren't good I would ever be in D.C. Maybe it was just a bluff, is what I'm saying. But I thought if I could just get a meeting with him, if I could show him what I was capable of, that I was going to be the next Jimenez, there was no way he wouldn't want to work with me. So I went to his gym, and every day I bounced around. Pow, pow, pow! Light as air on my feet. And then, boom! A hook you never saw coming. I wore red satin shorts and the best pair of boxing shoes I could afford. I was waiting for Solid to take notice, to see me and recognize that I was the champion. But after a few days, nothing. And when I finally asked one of the other guys about him, I found out that Solly had moved to Vermont, which was a place I'd never heard of back then. Vermont? What is that? I thought I would go. Vermont! Uh-huh! But I only made it as far as Delaware. I ran out of money on the way, so I got off here and found a job laying blacktop for a few days, trying to earn enough for another bus ticket. It was supposed to be temporary, but I was seal-coating the parking lot of this building, and the landlord, he used to stand out on the balcony, smoking a cigar while I worked. Name was Oscar. Turned out he was heading back to Montevideo, where he was from, and the guy who owned the building back then wanted him to find a replacement to manage the property. For some reason, he thought I could do the job. No way, I told him. I'm gonna be a boxer. He took one look at me and laughed. You? He said. I challenged him to an arm wrestling match. I said if I beat him, he had to give me the money for the ticket to Vermont. But if he beat me, I'd take the building manager job instead. Well, here I am. No shame in it. Who comes to the United States and ends up in Delaware? I, for one, never thought I'd be here. But I've been surprised. It's popular with the Latinos, and all because of the mushroom farms over in Pennsylvania. Half the mushrooms in the country are grown there. Back in the 70s, they used to hire Puerto Ricans to harvest everything, but now it's the Mexicans. And they used to set up the workers with housing, too. Shitty housing with rats as big as rabbits, boarded up windows, no hot water. After Reagan's amnesty deal, the workers started bringing their families up from Mexico. They didn't put their wives and children up in that shitty housing, though. They found other places to live, places like Delaware. It's cheaper than Pennsylvania, and no sales tax. We have all the Spanish supermarkets now, and the school district started those English programs. I know some people here think we're trying to take over, but we just want to be a part of it. We want to have our stake. This is our home, too. I like it here. I started off as the manager, but now I own this building. Bought it out almost 10 years ago after working jobs on the side, saving up. I got a good deal. The area is changing, though. A clash of cultures. I try to make this building like an island for all of us washed-ashore refugees. A safe harbor. I don't let anyone mess with me. If people want to tell me to go home, I just turn to them and smile politely and say, I'm already there.
Alma. I hadn't uttered a word to anyone about finding the boys Maribel. But ever since it happened, I hadn't been able to stop thinking about it either. I was suffocating under the weight of it. And I was furious at myself for letting him get to her, for creating an opening just big enough for him to slip through and find her. So finally, just after the New Year, I did what I should have done in the beginning. I went to the police. In Mexico, the police were corrupt and often powerless. No one trusted them. But maybe here, I thought, they would be different. The police station was a brick and glass building with an American flag cemented in the ground out front. Inside, it smelled of cleaning solvents. I strode up to a window behind a black counter where a woman in uniform sat, turning the pages of a magazine. Me llamo Alma Rivera, I said when I got to the counter, shouting so she could hear me through the glass. The woman held up one finger, got off her stool, and disappeared into another room. When she came back, a male officer with a chiseled face and a cleft in his chin accompanied her. He stood behind the glass and said in Spanish, I'm Officer Mora. Can we help you with something? I'm Alma Rivera, I shouted again in Spanish. I can hear you fine. How can we help you? I took a deep breath. I'm here about a boy. Officer Mora nodded. I waited for him to invite me behind the glass so we could talk in private, but he simply stood waiting for me to continue. There was no one else in the lobby, so I went on. I came home one day, and a boy was with my daughter. How old is your daughter? 15. And the boy? He's her age, I think. So, a teenage boy was with your teenage daughter, Officer Mora said. He had her against the wall of our building. Did he assault her? Officer Mora asked. He had her against the wall, I said again. Did you see him punch her? Or kick or physically harm her in any way? No, but the only reason he didn't was because I got there. Did he say something that made you think that? No, But he came for my daughter, I said again, frustration burning in my throat. Maybe she's friends with him. No. In our experience, parents don't always know what their teenage children are up to. You don't understand, I started. I had the urge to tell him about her brain injury, but I didn't want his pity. I only wanted his help. Officer Mora planted his hands on the counter behind the window. What I'm hearing is that you came home and found your daughter with a boy her age. That's all you know. Is she a pretty girl? He looked at us when we went to the gas station, I said. Who? The boy? He was staring at my daughter. Staring at her? Señora Rivera, that's not criminal. He had her shirt up, I said. Shame had kept me from revealing it sooner. I didn't want anyone, not even the police, to envision Maribel that way. Officer Mora's expression changed. When? When I found them the other day. You saw him pull her shirt up? No, but... So? She might have done that herself? She's not like that. Officer Mora rubbed the back of his neck, rolled his head around once, and took a deep breath. Señora, he said through the glass, this is a police station. We don't deal with teenage relationships here. Unless he assaulted her in some way or unless he made some kind of verbal threat, there's nothing we can do. I stared at him in disbelief. I thought you would help her. Officer Mora sighed, as if it were a great exertion to have to deal with me any longer. He said, we can't protect her from a boy who honestly probably just has a crush on her. That's your job. In English, he said something to the woman officer who shook her head before flipping another page of her magazine. I was a fool, I realized, to believe that they would care about any of this. I tightened my lips and straightened my purse strap on my shoulder with all the righteousness that I could muster. Neither Officer Mora nor the woman seemed to notice. Gracias, I said sarcastically. De nada, Officer Mora said in earnest, as if he believed he had done his job. I should have gone home, but anger roiled in my belly, and after I boarded the bus back to the apartment that day, I was seized by another idea. Fito had said the name of the neighborhood where the boy lived once. Capitol Oaks, wasn't it? If the police weren't going to help me, I thought, I would go over there myself. I walked up the aisle and tapped the bus driver on the shoulder. In my best English, I said, Capitol Oaks? He nodded and said something I didn't understand, but I waited behind him, hoping that when we got to the right stop, he would signal for me to get off. As the bus drove on, I pulled my dictionary from my purse to look up the words I wanted. I hadn't learned them yet in my English class. I had been to a few more since the first time, so I would have to teach them to myself. I looked up dejar, leave. Sola, alone. Leave alone. Leave alone, I said in my head. I practiced the words, mouthing them silently, until the driver stopped the bus and fluttered his hand over his shoulder at me. Capitol Oaks, he said. As soon as I got off the bus and turned around, I saw it. A neighborhood that was probably only 2 kilometers from us. A place I must have passed a dozen times and never noticed. Capitol Oaks, with a sign screwed into a low brick wall at the entrance, half covered by weeds. I crossed myself and whispered, "Dios me lleve," then clutched my purse and walked past the sign to the rows and rows of ranch-style houses. The yards were dry and overgrown, and lighted reindeer and inflated snow globes from Christmas still littered some of the front lawns. In Mexico, Arturo had built our house before we married. He and some friends had dug a plot of earth with shovels and pickaxes. For weeks, they had poured cement and laid rebar. They had stood in a line that stretched from a pile of cinder blocks to the foundation, heaving each block from one man to the next, until Arturo, who was nearest to the house, laid it. Until they had laid enough blocks that they rose high enough to call them walls. Into the hollows of one of the cinder blocks, the one centered just above the front door, Arturo placed a print of San Martin Caballero encased in a plastic bag to bring us luck. Here, on the house fronts, the paint was peeling and the porches sagged. Pickup trucks and two-door cars were parked in the driveways. I could feel like some sort of mist that hung in the air, that I was unwelcome. I walked for 10 minutes, maybe more. There was no sign of the boy, nor of anyone. Just a chill in the air, an arc of gray sky overhead. This wasn't going to work. There was no one here but me. And how did I think I was going to find him anyway without an address? I was heading back toward the entrance when behind me I heard a sound. I turned, and there, walking down the driveway of a brown, clabbered ranch-style house with rusted gutters and a storm door askew on its hinges, I saw him. The boy, dragging a trash can down the cracked driveway. He had seen me, I realized. He had been watching me wander down the street. He came out here on purpose. The two of us stood maybe 10 meters apart, fixed in place for a long time. Finally, the boy stood the trash can upright. He walked closer, and I felt the world constrict, my heart pulsing against my ribs. When we were only an arm's length apart, he stopped. I squeezed my hands around the lining of my pockets and whispered, "Leave alone." He stared at me from under the hood of his navy sweatshirt. From somewhere in my depths, somewhere beyond where I knew I could reach, I summoned enough courage to say it again, louder this time. "Leave alone." The boy locked his eyes on me and said something I didn't hear. He repeated it, and the second time I understood. "Go home," he said. I knew those words. And I knew by the way he said them that he didn't mean I should go back to the apartment. Then he lifted one hand and pointed at my face. He took a step forward and touched his fingertip to my cheek, to the bone that curved just under my left eye. He twisted his hand 45 degrees and cocked it like a gun. 3 fingers drawn back, his thumb up in the air, and let a burst of air explode from his lips, his warm breath like a ball of fire against my face. "Comprende?" he said. I felt lightheaded. I didn't know what to do. I wanted to leave. I wanted to run out of there and never see the boy again. But my feet were like dead weight. Move, I told myself in my head. Go, Alma! I turned around and forced myself to start walking, listening for the sound of his footsteps, bracing myself for him to run up and shove me from behind or knock me down or do whatever he was going to do. But there was only the swish of my jeans as my legs scissored past each other until I got to the main road. I was on edge the rest of the day. The encounter with the boy is sticking to me like burrs pricking at my skin. I couldn't shake it off. When Artur and I sat together at the kitchen table that night, I was quiet and preoccupied, staring into my cup of tea. The only sound, the knocking of the radiator. I could feel Arturo looking at me. I knew he could tell something was wrong. But unlike last time, he didn't ask what it was. I ran my fingers around the rim of the mug. Arturo cleared his throat and took another sip of tea. I lifted my eyes enough to watch him raise it to his mouth, to see his hands around the lacquered clay. Those rough hands. The onion-thin peels of skin around his thumbnails where he had bitten them. The scrapes on his knuckles where they rubbed against the top of the crate when he pulled mushrooms out from the soil inside. I saw the drooping neckline of the Baltimore Orioles sweatshirt we had bought from the Goodwill store, and that he wore around the house. The field of dark stubble along his jaw. I knew every inch of him, it seemed. And yet, in the last year, we'd had such trouble finding our way to each other. Before the accident, we had been the happiest people I knew. No one else, Arturo used to say to me, has ever been in love like we are. No one else even understands what that word means. We believed we were special. We believed we were indestructible. But after the accident, under the gathering clouds of fate, something changed. We still loved each other as much as we ever had. But it was as if neither of us knew what to do with that love anymore. It was as if our sorrow was so consuming that there was no room for anything else. When we did fall into bed together, or into each other's arms, pressing our bodies together, skin to skin, it was out of desperation. A longing to somehow rediscover what was familiar and what was good. But what used to feel like a communion only emphasized our grief, and eventually we had stopped trying altogether. Looking at him now, though, a fire roared up inside me. I was tired suddenly of feeling so bereft, so unmoored by sadness. I wanted to smother that feeling, to clear it from our lives like cobwebs from a dusty corner. I wanted to erase the anguish and the distance, the remorse and the blame, and replace it with something new. I wanted to figure out how to grope our way back to each other. Even now, even after the day I'd had, especially now. I lifted my foot under the table and rubbed it against Arturo's leg. He looked at me, startled. What? He asked. I pushed back from the table and walked to him. What are you doing? He asked. I put my hand on the back of his neck, leaned down, kissing his skin, breathing in the scent of his hair. Alma, he said, curling away. I lifted his hand from the mug. What is all this? I asked, touching the frayed skin around his thumbnail. I raised his hand to my lips, closing my mouth around his thumb, waiting to see if he would protest. I sucked each of his fingers one by one while he watched. And then I climbed on top of him, straddled his lap. I miss you, I murmured. Arturo put his hands on my hips and pulled me toward him. I'm here, he said. Closer, I said. He shimmied me closer and buried his face in my neck. I spread my fingers through his hair, feeling the warmth of his scalp, the faint scratch of his mustache against my skin. And by the time he pushed himself inside me, I believed that even after everything, even after the accident, and having traveled so far, leaving behind the landscape that we had woken up to every morning our whole lives, cedar mountains and citrus groves, a blue lake and mango trees. No matter what else happened, we would be fine as long as we had each other. Contigo, la milpa es rancho, y el atole champurrado. And then, the rush. It was as if the whole world sighed. As if every human, and every creature, and every gas and liquid and speck of dirt, and granule of sand and gust of air settled all at once. And all was right in the universe. If only for that moment.
Mayor. Not long after New Year's, my tía Gloria called my mom to say that her divorce had gone through.
Esteban is no longer part of my life, she said.
My mom burst into tears.
Why are you crying? My aunt asked. It's good news. And listen to this. He has to pay me.
What do you mean? My mom asked, sniffling.
I'm getting $80,000 from the settlement.
My mom's tears dried up immediately. Her voice turned serious.
How much?
It's from that summer house he had. The one his father gave him that we never went to. He has to liquidate it and I'm getting the money. And, my mom told us over dinner that night, she's giving some of it to us. She was pink in the face, barely able to contain herself. My dad wiped his mouth with a napkin.
How much is she giving us? $50?
He smirked.
Well, that was nasty, my mom said. You're going to feel bad when I tell you the real number.
I peeked at my dad, who was waiting with the napkin clutched in his hand. My mom started eating again, delicately picking the capers off the rice with the tines of her fork. She took at least 4 bites before my dad finally said,
Well, don't keep it a secret.
A grin played on my mom's lips.
Never mind then, my dad said.
You don't want to know?
Why would she be giving us money anyway?
Because we need it.
Who needs it? Not us. We're fine.
We're fine? Now we're fine? For months, you've been talking about how you might lose your job. But now you're telling me we're fine?
Yes.
Unbelievable. My dad shoveled rice into his mouth, probably to stop himself from saying anything else. But my mom couldn't let it go.
I'm only saying we could use the money.
My dad dropped his fork onto his plate with a clatter.
Jesus, Celia! I told you we don't need it. What's she giving us? $100? $200? We don't need it.
If you don't want to take it, you don't have to. I'll just keep it for myself then.
What is that supposed to mean?
What I said.
You want to leave?
Who said anything about leaving?
You take this, I take that. Is that what you're doing? Just like Gloria?
My mom rolled her eyes. But my dad was in a groove. He lifted his plate from the table and slammed it down, scattering rice and capers and peppers and chicken across the floor.
God damn it, Celia! How many times do I have to tell you that I will take care of this family? What do you think I'm doing out there every day? You think I'm working my ass off for fun?
He stood, toppling his chair. My mom pursed her lips and stared at her plate. He reached across the table and seized both of her wrists.
Look at me when I'm talking to you!
But as soon as she did, my dad threw her wrists back at her in disgust.
I don't know how many times,
he muttered, shaking his head. Then he turned, using his leg to sweep aside the chair, which was on its back on the floor, stepped over the food, and walked out of the kitchen. The clock on the wall ticked faintly. The glass bottles of vinegar and hot sauce that my mom kept on the shelves inside the refrigerator door rattled. I felt embarrassed for my mom, who sat across from me, screwing up her face like she was determined not to cry. But I stayed absolutely silent, waiting to see what would happen next. Finally, my mom said quietly,
Mayor, finish your chicken.
2 days later, my dad and I learned the news. Tia Gloria was giving us $10,000. After the heat between my parents died down, my mom blurted out the number during dinner. My dad nearly choked on his food.
I can't believe it, my mom kept saying. Well, we've probably given her almost as much money over the years,
my dad said, once he'd recovered from the shock.
$10,000, Rafa? Come on. We did what we could,
my dad said.
Of course we did. And now she's doing the same. It's just that she can afford to do more.
$10,000! I can't believe it!
It didn't take my dad quite as long to wrap his head around the idea. The morning the money landed in my parents' bank account, my dad said,
I think we should buy a car.
A what?
My mom sputtered as she snapped a piece of bacon and popped it in her mouth.
Nothing fancy, my dad said. I'm not talking about an Alfa Romeo here, but a car. Something that runs.
He was happy, I could tell, at the mere thought.
A car?
My mom asked, dumbfounded.
Yes. You've heard of it? 4 wheels, takes gasoline.
It was no secret that since he was a boy, my dad had lusted after cars, and the pinnacle of his obsession would have been to own one. Once, he bought an issue of Auto Week at the Newark newsstand, and for the past few years, he'd consoled himself by flipping through it while he lay on the couch, licking his thumb before he turned each thin, glossy page, staring for what seemed like hours at a sleek black Maserati or a balloonish blue Bugatti. Enrique and I used to make fun of him about it. But even when the pages eventually started falling out, my dad just taped them together and flipped through it again.
But what will we do with the car?
My mom asked. She looked at my dad now with mild amusement, as if he had just suggested they buy an elephant.
What do you think?
My dad said.
We'll drive it.
Where?
Anywhere. You could drive to the Pathmark.
I don't know how to drive.
You learn. Can I drive it? I asked.
You don't have a license yet, my dad said.
But when I get one, I mean.
Rafa, be serious, my mom went on. We don't need a car. We could go to Panama 10 times with that money.
My dad rubbed his chin. He looked at the two of us, sitting there, eating breakfast. I could tell, and I'm sure my mom could too, that he had made up his mind. "We're getting a car," he said. The auto dealerships in our town were on Cleveland Avenue. Cars waxed and gleaming, plastic pennant flags crisscrossed over the lots. But of course, because my dad was always looking for a bargain, Cleveland Avenue wasn't where we went. We took a bus instead to a used car lot that my dad had found through an ad in the newspaper. It was in the middle of nowhere, and the winter sun shone over the acres and acres of land that surrounded it. The hard grass crunched under our feet as we walked, and the wind squealed, tearing holes through the air. My mom grimaced and pulled the collar of her coat up around her face.
"Is it supposed to snow today?" she asked.
My dad was already way ahead of us.
"It's supposed to snow?" I said, excited by the prospect. "I don't know. I'm just asking. I can't believe it's January and we haven't even had flurries yet."
I looked up at the sky. Even though the air was frigid, it seemed to me like the sun was too bright for snow. But maybe I was wrong. I hoped I was wrong. The only reason I'd come was because my dad